Welcome, Brother Tom Gilbert, and he's going to speak to us on the topic of being who you need me to be. Being who you need me to be. Brother Tom.
Thank you, Brother Peter. Good morning, brethren. It's always a pleasure to be with brethren in convention and to be here in Chicago. And some of our class, Paul and Jean Meser, are here with our family. I'm sure that Neil and Dixie Hamilton, who ended up not being able to come, would like their greetings sent to you, along with the others with whom we meet. And I know that Jan's mother, Sister Evelyn McAllister, would like her greetings given to you as well. What a blessed privilege we have been offered to follow in the footsteps of God's dear Son. Jesus came as the singular example of human perfection, since the first two humans had been cast out of the perfect environment in which they had lived for a time. Now he had come to earth, and we're thankful that so many in the world have just so recently marked that event, the memory of that event. He had come to earth at his father's request to follow a course that would satisfy justice, but also demonstrate God's love, his mercy, and his compassion. He spent his first 30 years here on earth living in a family environment, in a community, and in a nation that was in subjection to the Roman Empire. It was largely an obscure existence during those 30 years, during which he was learning and growing. And at 30 years of age, he left his family and his work as a carpenter, met his cousin John at the River Jordan, was baptized, and became a traveling teacher. His message was familiar, but yet different. He spoke about the law that had been given to Israel by God through Moses, but he challenged his listeners to live by the spirit of that law rather than by the letter of the law. Even though the nation was under Roman domination, he encouraged his listeners to revive their hope for the kingdom taught by all of God's holy prophets, wherein Israel would be the chief nation, not to dominate and subject others, as Rome was at that time, but to spread God's blessings to all peoples on earth. It was a promise that had been given to their forefather, Abraham. He developed a reputation as a charismatic teacher, much to the chagrin of the scribes and the Pharisees. But the main role that he wanted to project, especially to his closest followers, was that of being a servant. He attracted and called 12 disciples who traveled with him for those 3.5 years, listening to him teach, observing how he acted, and dialoguing with them about what they heard and saw as they walked the dusty roads from village to village in Galilee and Judea. It seemed at times that they were carried away with a feeling of importance as his disciples, as again and again, thousands of people turned out to hear Jesus teach. The scribes and the Pharisees, after all, couldn't draw such crowds. And so several times during the 3.5 years of Jesus' ministry, the record tells us that his disciples began to debate among themselves which of them would be greatest in the kingdom of heaven. One time, the mother of two of the disciples approached Jesus and asked if her sons could have the closest seats to Jesus in the heavenly courts. And the other disciples were angry with jealousy. The disciples were learning about the kingdom. They were learning about the spiritual principles embodied in the law. They were learning about love and righteousness. But they were missing an important point, a deep, subtle message of servitude that Jesus had been attempting to model for them in all that he did. Using teachable moments, he tried to explain this important element of character to them. At one of those moments, he said, "You know that the rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their high officials exercise authority over them. Not so with you. Instead, whoever wants to become great among you must be your servant. And whoever wants to be first must be your slave. Just as the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many." On another occasion, they came to Capernaum. And when he was in the house, he asked them, "What were you arguing about on the road today?" But they kept quiet because on the way they had argued about who was the greatest. Sitting down, Jesus called the 12 and said, "If anyone wants to be first, he must be the very last and the servant of all." According to some of the gospel accounts, the disciples even rekindled the debate at the Last Supper they had with Jesus on the night before he died. Imagine at that time. And so John records in his gospel that perhaps in a final, maybe desperate act or attempt to impress the lesson of service, Jesus arose from his place at the table and washed the disciples' feet. The record is in John 13, which we're going to read. "So he got up from the meal, took off his outer clothing, and wrapped a towel around his waist. After that, he poured water into a basin and began to wash his disciples' feet, drying them with the towel that was wrapped around him. He came to Simon Peter, who said to him, 'Lord, are you going to wash my feet?' Jesus replied, 'You do not realize now what I am doing, but later you will understand.' 'No,' said Peter, 'you shall never wash my feet.' Jesus answered, 'Unless I wash you, you have no part in me.' 'Then, Lord,' Peter replied, 'not just my feet, but my hands and my head as well.' Jesus answered, 'A person who has had a bath needs only to wash his feet. His whole body is clean, and you are clean, though not every one of you.' For he knew who was going to betray him, and that was why he said not everyone was clean. When he had finished washing their feet, he put on his clothes and returned to his place. 'Do you understand what I have done for you?' he asked. 'You call me teacher and Lord, and rightly so, for that is what I am. Now I, your Lord and teacher, have washed your feet. You should also wash one another's feet. I have set you an example that you should do as I have done for you. I tell you the truth, no servant is greater than his master.'" I lost my place. Pages out of order. "No messenger greater than the one who sent him. Now that ye know these things, you will be blessed if you do them." Jesus was hoping that they would finally get this important message. And Jesus' disciples down to the present day have faced the same challenge. To overcome this human tendency to want to be recognized as great in men's eyes and instead lead a life that marks them as the lowliest, that of servants. But by the Lord's grace, we have understood our Master's lessons that God recognizes the servant of all to be the greatest of all. And it has to be done with willing sincerity. We cannot merely go through the motions of serving others in order to gain recognition from God. He can see through all insincerity and hypocrisy. How well are we learning this important lesson? Well, none of us can speak for anyone else. Our progress is a matter between us and God, but in our association with one another, we can encourage one another along this line. And it is in this spirit that I share these thoughts with you today. These are thoughts that have come to me over the past year or so, especially in this post-working career period of my life, where my mind has had more time for contemplation and meditation and study. And new experiences have filled some of that time formerly occupied with earning a salary. Now, I would tell you that these are just my thoughts, what I am learning and seeing. If you think I say something that sounds profound and deep, realizing that I am sharing a perspective on how lessons have reached my mind, getting these down into my heart and translating them into performance so it changes my character is another matter, and that struggle will continue to the end of my days. The human tendencies in my nature are alive and well, as those who know me best can attest. But I want to begin by telling you about a distinct shift that occurred in my thinking over this recent period. My faith in God's promises is such that I have no fear of death. I'm sure all or most of you probably feel the same. Well, I admit I have a few fears of certain ways of dying, but I do not fear going out of existence. I have absolute confidence that there is no suffering in that condition, and our righteous God will restore me to life if it serves his purposes to do so. And he will place me wherever it is appropriate in his kingdom according to his mercy and his grace. With that context in mind, I must admit that in recent years, I had personally rejoiced in the thought that of the Lord bringing my earthly life to an end at the earliest possible time so that I might have the privilege of entering into his presence and service in heaven as soon as possible, assuming he found my character acceptable and my life skills useful to his purposes. Now, I didn't always feel that way. Because of my struggle with depression and low self-esteem for many years, I had always envisioned myself meeting Jesus with my head bent down, staring at the ground, too ashamed of my performance, of my many sins, to even look him in the face. And I know through fellowship that other brethren struggle with that same image in their mind, because they have told me and shared that with me. Having largely overcome the depression, I have a different vision now, realizing that if I do have the privilege of meeting Jesus, I will be beaming with delight because I understand the depth and breadth of his forgiveness and covering of my sins. And if I am there, he has found me useful. If I find myself in Jesus' presence someday, there will be only joy. But in the past year, as I said, my thinking has changed. For myself, I see that my desire to leave this earth with the hope that I will meet the Master is just that. My desire. My will. I wasn't thinking of anyone else. Over the past year, the Lord has shown me the fact that many people depend on me, not because I'm 100% dependable, for sure, but there are ways I serve various people in my life, however imperfectly. My wife, my children, my brethren, my friends, and even strangers, about which I will say more later. And if I was gone with my desire as soon as possible, would leave a gap in things that I had formerly done. And I have realized how much of my life has been structured around what I wanted to do, what I wanted to accomplish. Interruption of those plans used to cause me a degree of annoyance, more in the past, but less as years have gone by. Now, as I come more and more to see my purpose being serving others' needs, whatever those needs may be and whenever they may be needed, my desire is to continue that service as long as I am able. My desire is to be whatever God needs me to be, whatever my wife needs me to be, whatever my children need to be, whatever the brethren need me to be, and so forth. Anyone who has a need that I can serve, I want to be that for them. Again, I will apologize to those who know me if my words seem much more lofty than the reality of my performance. I am sure the Lord has a similar perspective as I begin this refocusing of how I see the purpose of my life. I trust He will help and guide me in my efforts to make this a reality, as I would be pleased with any encouragement and guidance that my brethren might give me. As I look at my life, I see many things that God has needed me to be, or in another way of speaking, that God has needed me to experience. God has needed me to experience mental illness, suffering, as I have said before, with depression, including 22 years after I committed my life to Him. Twice I reached the point of considering suicide, but I did not attempt it. Eventually, He allowed my depression to be diagnosed and treated so that I am relatively free of it today, although occasionally I have relapses. In retrospect, I can thank God for this experience. It allows me to serve others who are similarly afflicted, including brethren, to be a support and an encouragement. It is a joy to continue to serve in others in that way, if it be God's will. It gives a purpose, as all of you know from your own experiences, it gives purpose to the sufferings and afflictions that you go through. And oh, how we love that statement in 2 Corinthians, the first chapter, "Blessed be the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, the Father of mercies and God of all comfort, who comforts us in all our affliction, so that we may be able to comfort those who are in any affliction with the comfort with which we ourselves are comforted by God." God has blessed me with a very strong sister in Christ to be my wife, who has endured my many weaknesses and failings, and yet shown me deep acceptance that has helped me to learn to accept myself. My depression created untold stress on her and the family, and then we adopted two sons who turned out to have mental health challenges themselves. I think God needed Sister Jan and I to have that experience. The stresses within our family nearly tore our family apart. As I have previously related, in desperation over those stresses, we went to see a marriage counselor and went in marriage counseling for a year and a half. Social services professionals who came into our home to work with us as a family were of help. And while Jan and I sometimes felt like failures trying to make things work, the professionals paid us high compliments. The fact that we had remained together. The majority of families who deal with the challenges you have, they said, break apart and end in divorce. From those experiences, Jan and I realized that perhaps our most foundational strength was keeping our commitments. We aren't quitters. And these experiences have enabled us to serve as supports for brethren and others who experienced or are experiencing similar circumstances. It is a role of being of service. And our God was leading us through those experiences to make us fit to serve others in that way. Now, with my refocused understanding of purpose for my life, and brethren, if you're sitting there thinking, what, he's finally just getting that now? What can I say? I am who I am. Maybe all of you are looking back at that point you reached in your life, and now you're saying, the brother up there is just finally getting there. You may be all farther down that road than I have, but I'm glad for this insight that God has let me see about my life. I want to continue to serve our sons as parents as long as possible. You know, it's someone I was sharing this with said, do you have a lack of faith that God would take care of them if you were gone? No, it's not that. I have no doubt about that. But my desire now is simply to be that person, to continue to be that person through whom God provides that service and support as long as possible. Jan and I find meaning and purpose in doing that. Now, as perhaps a humorous aside, at one point of absolute frustration in our challenges as parents of our sons, when there seemed to be no clear solution to circumstances, I remember having a conversation with God about it. It was not the only occasion. Knowing fairly well the challenges that Brother Larry and Sister Debbie McClellan had in parenting their two sons, I asked God whether Jan and I really had to have similar experiences when two brethren already possessed the lessons from such experiences to help mankind in the kingdom. I seriously said to the Lord, Lord, do you really need backup capabilities? Do you need redundancy in the body of Christ? Apparently, there will be many among mankind who will need the application of such lessons. As I have left the field of having a paid career, I had more time, and I decided that I would like to look in my community for ways that I could serve other people. People I didn't even know. I applied to work as a volunteer at Habitat for Humanity Restore, but they had no need for additional volunteers. So I applied at the food pantry in our community. They did not have a need for volunteers in the food pantry either, but they had a need for another service, that of senior drivers, volunteers who take seniors without any transportation to medical appointments, shopping, to the food pantry itself, and so forth. I also applied to be a volunteer at the Middleton Senior Center, and they had the very same need. They had a program providing rides to seniors. These people lack the ability to get themselves around, cannot take a bus, they need door-to-door transportation, and cannot afford a cab. Most of them live in subsidized public or quasi-public housing. So now I work for both of these community agencies, providing rides usually once a week for each one. I also volunteered to do chores for seniors, and next week I will help a senior who has just moved into an apartment hang pictures and decorations on her walls. The life stories I hear from these people are amazing, often sad. I transported a man the week before Christmas. He needed help keeping his balance as he got out of the car and took that one or two steps until he reached his walker, because he said, "I have no toes." He did not say why. Now, I realize that some of the things I'm saying might be interpreted by some of you as recommending or advocating certain courses in life or activities to be pursued. These are choices I have made. I am not really intending that to be the purpose of my remarks. I'm just telling you some of the things that I have found delightful in the way of service. So please forgive me if I have said anything that you find offensive. Another thing God has needed to me to be, family has needed me to be, workers at work have needed to be, don't laugh, but God has needed me to be a voice of calm reason in many situations in life. And by his grace, he has taught me to be that, usually, not always. There have been many stressful times when I wish that I could allow myself to melt in a puddle of overflowing emotions, especially when others around me were doing so. But that is not what he or the people around me needed me to be. And God has given me many experiences to teach me that reason is scarce where emotions run deep, and someone needs to be the calm, reasonable voice in such situations. Reason has appealed to me and resonated with me, especially since I heard the invitation from God who said, "Come now and let us reason together." Let me speak of others' examples. My dear wife, Sister Jan, made a major life commitment back in the mid-1990s. It was clear that our sons needed constant supervision, especially at the age they were. She saw that once our sons were middle school age, they would be too old to be in the summer daycare programs available to families who had two working parents. They would be at home, and it would not work for them to be unsupervised. Jan saw the need of our family at about age 44. I might have the year wrong. She went back to school full-time while also working full-time to earn her master's degree in special education and returned to teaching so that she would have her summers free to be at home. Jan became what her family needed her to be. It seemed the only workable course, and submissive to the realities which presented themselves, she pursued it. She became what her family needed her to be. God has needed some of you to serve him in an isolated situation. And God has needed others of you to serve as supports for those who are isolated. Those who have experienced isolation understand best the needs of others similarly situated. And God saw that God needed them to become supports. The outstanding example that I am most familiar with, of course, is Sisters Marguerite and Rosalind Roswick. Isolated themselves for many years, they had a worldwide ministry to others that were in that situation. The numbers of those they were serving was truly amazing. Another good example here was here in Chicago. Until her recent passing, Sister Joy Candle regularly wrote letters and cards to Jan's mother, Evelyn McAllister, who now resides in an assisted living home near us. We visit her 3 times a week, but she is unable to come out to meetings, and the letters and cards from Sister Joy were such a precious blessing to her. Brethren, we look around us and see, who does God need me to be? Who do my brethren need me to be? And identify a way that we can serve. God and your families have needed many of you to be caregivers to family members who had special needs, whether of a disease or disability or agedness. And we know, and I'm sure you know through fellowship with those who have been in that situation, that some of those experiences have been very, very hard and lasted many years. You didn't necessarily, those of you in that situation didn't necessarily ask for that pathway in life. It may not necessarily have been part of the vision you saw before you. But there it was, and you became what that person needed you to be. You served with willing acquiescence or submission to the course that God had allowed to come to pass. And similarly, some of you have lost spouses while children were not yet grown and on their own, and they needed you to make alterations in your life to fill that void. Painful as those experiences were, you became what your children needed you to be. And sometimes the older children in the family had to alter their course and fill gaps, becoming what their younger siblings needed them to be. Some have had experiences that have brought them into contact with the criminal justice system. Some of the Lord's people have experienced consequences in the system themselves. It was not in Jan's and my plans to learn about it, but our son took us there. And while we would not have wished that experience for our son or ourselves, we thank God that we have a much better understanding of life experiences of others, inmates, their families, court officials, and even prison guards, of whom we had little understanding about their lives before. We see the need for the kingdom. God needed us to understand these experiences. We at one time considered relocating in retirement to warmer climes, but at least until recently, we were the only ones who visited our son, Aaron. How could we leave our child completely alone in prison? Aaron needed us to be there. Brethren, the picture that I'm trying to paint is one where our lives are characterized by serving others in response to the needs that present themselves to us. A submissive, accepting servitude that is marked not by plans and decisions about what we want to do for others, but by the needs of others that become known to us in one way or the other. My desire as I refocus is to see my purpose in serving the needs of others in the way that they need it, rather than following a course marked out by what I would like to do. I want to live to serve in this way as long as I can, because in serving others in the unique ways that God has equipped or developed me, in serving others, I become more emotionally attached and invested in their lives, and I understand more deeply why God laid out a plan to rescue and save his human creation. I understand more deeply the purpose for the church and the sin offering arrangement, whereby the church's experiences will help mankind recover and progress up the highway that leads to holiness. Thus I understand more deeply the very purpose of my life and the various experiences of life through which God has led me. And that has made my life and every experience more exciting as I look in wonder for the lessons that God may have for me each day. I gain new understandings of how I can be useful to others now and at the same time become better prepared for the service in Christ's kingdom. Paul says, as we have opportunity, let us do good unto all men, especially unto them who are of the household of faith. As I consider this subject of servitude and being who God needed me to be, it quite logically occurred to me that our Lord Jesus was the ultimate example of being who God needed him to be. God was willing to sacrifice his Son to save mankind. The more that I serve others, the more I understand, and I understand more deeply why Jesus was willing, nay, joyous, according to Hebrews 2:9, to leave his Father's presence, come down to earth, and endure the things that he did. The more that I interact with the world of mankind, the more I realize the passion that God and Jesus have for the successful accomplishment of their plan of salvation. The more I can understand why they see the value in rescuing mankind from sin and death. The more I can understand the need for the church class and the sin offering experiences that they must have to be of use in the reconciliation work in God's kingdom. As I was studying this, I came across another article in the reprints that gave me a very different perspective on how Jehovah and his Son interacted in the formulation and implementation of the plan of salvation. Very different from what I had before. Maybe some of you already have this point, but at least when I read the article, I did not recall hearing this or reading it before. It's an article from 1903 entitled The Oneness of the Divine Family. It's reprint 3160. I'm going to read you several paragraphs from that. In the first place, we notice that the one purpose which is common to both the Father and the Son is the Father's purpose, which was gradually revealed to the Son in due time and order, whose it also became by adoption. Jesus himself said, "Of that day and hour knoweth no man, no, not the angels which are in heaven, neither the Son, but the Father only." It is manifest that the revelation of that plan to him was a gradual one, and that he was led into the knowledge of its various features as they became due to be worked out through his instrumentality. Thus, he was allowed to grow in knowledge, and thus, too, he was spared the sad spectacle of subsequent trouble, which also lay along the pathway of the divine plan. Thus, while he joyfully worked out the grand plan of creation, he probably knew nothing of God's purpose for the subsequent permission of evil and the necessity for the great work of redemption. Before he came to that test of faith in God, his confidence in the Almighty's power, wisdom, and love had already been firmly established by experiences of the past. For centuries he had seen his Father's mighty works, marked his wondrous wisdom and experience, and his tender love. Could he doubt then, when another feature of his plan made manifest the great work of redemption and restitution and gave to him the privilege of undertaking this work also for the joy that the Father set before him? No, doubtless he did not at first realize the depths of humiliation and sorrow through which he must pass. But step by step, along the painful way of humiliation and suffering, his faith in the Father, founded upon his previous experiential knowledge, sustained him, as it is written, "By his knowledge shall my righteous servant justify many." We next notice between the Father and the Son a beautiful oneness of confidence. The Son trusted the Father fully, at first because it was easy and natural. Created in the likeness of God, trust in the being who brought him into existence was spontaneous, and experience served but to develop and establish it further. The Father did not treat the Son as a servant and hide his purposes from him, but delighted to take him into his confidence insofar as his wisdom and prudence dictated. That is, as the truth became meat in due season for him. And in turn, the Son did not serve the Father as an hireling, but as a son with common interest. The Father declared, "This is my beloved Son." And the Son said, "I delight to do thy will." How blessed the fellowship. It was a fellowship of joy and a fellowship of suffering, of joy in a common anticipation of the future glory, and of suffering in mutual participation of the preliminary trials to secure that end. The Son suffered in his humiliation and his dying agony, and the Father suffered in giving his only begotten Son, an intensity of suffering which the loving, yearning hearts of devoted parents can best imagine and understand. This, brethren, was really a new thought to me that I don't remember hearing or reading before, that the Logos, Jesus, did not know the details of what God was going to ask him from the very beginning. I assumed he fully knew from the very beginning what his Father needed him to do, what his Father needed him to be, and that he willingly agreed to do this before even the things had been set in motion. But this article suggests a very different picture. That Jehovah only revealed to his Son that wisdom, what wisdom dictated was necessary for him to know at each step of the plan. Following this line of thinking, then, at some point, Jehovah revealed to his Son the need for a ransom sacrifice to meet the requirements of justice. And at that time, our Lord had to make a decision. Was he willing to leave his heavenly home, his intimate relationship with his Father, to go and live among the sinful and degraded race of mankind, to be unjustly accused, convicted, and put to death on a cross as a blasphemer against his own Father? Maybe we have not thought deeply about the magnitude of what God asked his Son to do. I had not previously considered that the Father put this question before his Son at a later time, after the foundation of the world. As I considered the magnitude of what God was asking his Son to do, it occurred to me that perhaps I had an answer to a question I have long wondered about. Why did God create his Son first and have the Logos carry out all of the creative plans as his Father's master craftsman, as one translation puts it in Proverbs 8? Why didn't God personally exercise his creative power and create all that we see and then bring his Son into existence after that? Why have his Son do it? Well, the only answer I have heard before is that it gave him more joy. But as I have thought about it in this study, the answer that appeals to me is that because the Father knew the enormous magnitude of what he was going to ask his Son to do, and that there might be some hesitancy of leaving his Father's presence and going through all these experiences, but by allowing the Logos to do the creative work on behalf of his Father, he would already have a very deep emotional investment and attachment to the human race. By agreeing to his Father's proposal, Jesus was not just saving his Father's work. He was saving the work of his own hands. The wisdom of this approach, when it occurred to me, literally took my breath away. Wow. And then considered the parallel to our own course. It's so evident. God has called us to follow a similar course as his Son. Because we, like the priests of Israel, are called out from among mankind and understand their plight through our common experiences, we have a strong emotional attachment that enables us to offer ourselves to be what God needs us to be. And the more we can serve the needs of others, to be what they need us to be for them, the more deeply will be our emotional investment in their future. And the easier it will be to lay down our lives day by day on their behalf. What an awesome God we have. What an awesome plan of redemption he has laid out. Brethren, as I come to the closing of thoughts here, I realize that some of these thoughts may have been different, and it wasn't a deep scriptural study. But it was my hope to lay out a strong appeal of doing our best to live a life of service to God and to anyone around us who has a need that we can help meet. And I realize some of my thoughts may have even been a bit speculative. To me, at least, this line of reasoning has made the path of serving others, of being what they need me to be, a bit easier and more joyous. Perhaps they will be helpful to you in the same way. I would like to close with a poem from the reprints, from page 5644. Love is the filling from one's own another's cup. Love is a daily laying down and taking up, a choosing of the stony path through each new day, that other feet may tread with ease a smoother way. Love is not blind, but looks abroad through others' eyes, and asks not, must I give, but may I sacrifice? Love hides its grief, that other hearts and lips may sing, and burdened walks, that other lives may buoyant wing. Brother, hast thou a love like this within thy soul? 'Twill change thy name to saint when thou hast reached thy goal. I pray that the Lord will bless each one of you. And I thank you for the time to share these thoughts with you. The hymn we're going to close with, you've probably seen the papers at your place. As I was working on this study, the title line of this started going through my head, and I thought, I must have heard that somewhere. And as I searched for it through the wonderful internet and found it, I realized it had the ideal sentiments to go along with our thoughts today. So I pray that it may also be a blessing and reinforce the attitude of being a servant.